This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Margarita Balmaseda, author of Russian Energy Chains, the remaking of technopolitics from Siberia to Ukraine to the European Union. The book was published by Columbia University Press in 2021. Margarita Balmaseda is a professor of diplomacy and international relations at Seton Hall University. She's also an associate at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies and at the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute. Her books include The Politics of Energy Dependency, Ukraine, Belarus, and Lithuania Between Domestic Oligarchs and Russian Pressure, and Living the High Life in Minsk, Russian Energy Rents, Domestic Populism, and Belarus Impending Crisis, Energy Dependency, Politics, and Corruption in the Former Soviet Union. Capitalizing on her Ukrainian, Russian, Hungarian, and German skills, in addition to her native Spanish, Margarita Balmaseda has conducted extensive research in Ukraine, Russia, Belarus, Lithuania, Moldova, Hungary, Germany, and Finland. A specialist on the comparative energy politics of the post-Soviet states, since 2000, she has been following the pipeline that is following the complex web of interconnections that accompany the energy relationship between Russian oil and gas producers, post-Soviet transit states, and European consumers. Hello, Margarita.
Hello, Natalia. Nice to be here.
So congratulations on your new book. And I hope today we'll have a chance to talk about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which has received a lot of attention both in Europe and in the States. So, but first, I would like to talk a little bit about the introductory part of your book. So, in the introduction, you explain how the notions of power and energy resources are understood. These also appear crucial for the subsequent discussion. Depending on how we understand power and energy resources, we construct the way we approach these issues, which are connected with these notions. So what is power and what energy resources are discussed in your book?
Well, that's a very good way to start a conversation because some of the things that have propelled me to work exactly on this book have been my lack of confidence or dissatisfaction with the way the concept of power has been used, in particular in dealing with energy, but also the way in which the concept of energy resources has been used. And to put this in a nutshell, very often the literature on energy and politics talks about energy power as exclusively external power. In the book, I call this power over. Underestimating that energy and control over energy resources can also create very important preconditions for domestic power and for empowering certain domestic actors. In a nutshell, I call this power two. And I think this is important because the way we have traditionally looked at energy and power has been simply in terms of external power, especially when we're talking about the Russian relationship with countries like Ukraine, and neglecting the domestic element is a problem. The other side of the question about the energy resources that are included in this book or not included, that is also important because of two issues. First of all, traditionally, we have in the West basically focused all our attention on oil. But even worse than that, we have kind of subsumed every other type of energy under oil and assumed that everything works as oil. And I remember even discussions in the 2006 Ukrainian-Russian energy crisis, 2009 Russian-Ukraine energy crisis, experts or supposed experts on energy here in the U.S. were mistakenly confusing natural gas and oil. I don't think that happens anymore, but one of the goals of this book is to show how different these different types of energy are. And since I didn't have unlimited amounts of time, I limited myself to three types of energy. I focused on natural gas, on oil, but also on coal, which is a type of energy that is very, very seldom discussed. And I made a point of discussing that in this book. Of course, there are other types of energy. I didn't have the time to get into nuclear power, for example, or into renewables. But these three types of energy are focused on because they are the key three types of energy that Russia is exporting, not only to Ukraine, but to European Union. For example, the European Union's supply of both oil, natural gas, and coal are about 35% coming from Russia, each of them. So in a sense, you can talk about them as a group, mm-hmm. besides the fact that they are fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned that you were dissatisfied, right, with how power was understood. So I would like you to follow up on this line and ask you, how does your book intervene with how Russian energy supplies are understood in existing body of literature?
The existing literature, and maybe here I'm painting a large field with a broad brush, focuses on Russia's using energy as an element of external power, as an element of pressure. I have no doubt that Russia has done that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, there's no doubt that Russia has done that or continues to do that. But what is missing from that discussion is how do domestic players in other states that are not Russia, in Russia, but also in these other states, play a role here? We do not have simply a situation of bad Russia or bad Russian oligarchs in cahoots or in coordination with Putin oppressing Ukraine. We have a situation where for many, many years, domestic Ukrainian players also played a role in maintaining a situation of dependency. And even today, we see a situation where domestic European Union players are very happy to collaborate with Russian energy players. And even within Russia, we cannot simply talk about one single energy power. We know, for example, and just to very indirectly touch upon Nord Stream 2, that many of those large infrastructure programs supported by the Russian state are first and foremost supporting the enrichment of Putin's friends who are involved in the building of this. those other players. Not to say that Russia does not use energy as a weapon, but to clarify how this happens and the key role of domestic players, of some domestic players at least, even more. For example, if Russia's energy power had simply been a matter of external power, it really would not have been able to be so powerful. It would not have been able to penetrate so deeply as it did. And therefore, even if I am saying you cannot simply see energy relations in terms of a Russian external power, looking at domestic players actually helps you better understand that energy power. So that was the idea I was trying to present. Mm-hmm.
And well, as you mentioned, you chose to focus on three types of energy, and there is some certain time period that your book specifies as well. Would you talk a little bit about what time period you focus on and why?
Yes. So, I mean, if you look at this book, it goes back and forth in time. Sometimes it even goes back to the end of the 19th century when steel-focused coal production started in Ukraine, for example. Or it brings us to the present with the discussion of Nord Stream. But since I have a lot of moving parts and I wanted to compare these three types of energy, natural gas, oil, and coal, I wanted to have as much as possible a stable focus period to base the kind of hardcore analysis on. And in this book, this period is from, I believe, October 2011 to the end of April, early May 2014. Why? Well, this is a very good period because it's a period where there is some kind of stability in world energy markets, in particular natural gas and oil. It's a period of relative price stability. And this is good because if I had taken a period where you have huge swings in prices, that complicates things so much. This is a period of relatively high prices of natural gas and in particular oil. And this is also, in terms of rules and regulations, a stable period. If you remember some of the discussions about Russian export duties, export regulations, by 2011, Russia had started a particular system of export duties on oil. That's not the most important thing in the book, but it's one example of how during that period we have kind of equal conditions or stable conditions. And that was important because I didn't want to have a period with a lot of changes. And of course, that period is tremendously telling and important because it is, I call it, the period of calm before the storm. Before the storm, of course, not only of the huge fall in oil prices in 2014, but the storm of the Russian intervention in Ukraine. And that's why I take that as a kind of basis period for kind of my hard numbers and my calculations.
Mm-hmm. So, and you make an intriguing observation. The countries which are believed to be hostage of the Russian gas pipeline, in fact, are also using the situation for their benefits and advantages. Doesn't mean that they are not really interested in reducing this dependency on the Russian gas and oil supplies.
Well, that is a very, very, very complex and one would even say very politically delicate issue. If you would ask any political official in Ukraine, even during the Kuchma period, which was strife with corruption, I wrote an entire book about this, they would say that yes, they would want to diversify, but they didn't do anything about it. If you take the period after 2014, they have been attempts at diversification, real attempts at diversification. But at the same time, there has been and continues to be a desire to continue to play an important role in those Russian energy chains, if only because of the income that Ukraine has received from those exports. And to understand the importance of this, and again, this is something that may come to bear if we start talking about Nord Stream later on, to understand the importance of this, we need to understand that basically the entire natural gas supply infrastructure in Ukraine, but also in Slovakia, in other Eastern European countries, emerged as part and parcel, not even as a byproduct, but as part and parcel of the tremendous expansion of Soviet natural gas exports in the 1970s. So this is not simply something that Ukraine or Slovakia could switch on and off. This role in the transit of those fossil fuels, in particular natural gas, is essential for the functioning of the entire system. It was also essential for income, yes, in terms of transit income. It was essential for many years for Ukraine to maintain quote-unquote low natural gas prices between 1994 to 1991 and 2004. Ukraine did not get paid separately for transit services, but everything was kind of combined in a low import price. So it benefited in many ways. Oligarchs benefited tremendously, especially until 2014. So I do not want to say that they did not want to diversify, but this has been a very, very long process. And if you go a little bit back in history, and this is something I discuss a lot in my 2008 book on energy dependence, politics, and corruption, if you go to the early post-Soviet period, 1991, 1992, 1993, 94, actually, Ukrainian policymakers and Ukrainian industrialists, the directors of very large companies, they refused to see Ukraine as an energy-dependent state because they still saw Ukraine within the context of that larger Soviet supply, even when Ukraine was no longer part of the Soviet Union, that larger supply system. So yes, Ukraine benefited. That has touched every aspect of Ukraine's development in the last 40 years, not only the last 30 years of independence, but even before. But I want to emphasize, the Soviet Union benefited tremendously from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. If you read the chapter on natural gas, you may remember that Ukrainian territory provided huge services in terms of storage facilities for that Soviet gas to be parked before sending it during the winter months to Europe, in terms of supplies, actually, in the 1960s, when Ukraine was still very active in terms of natural gas production. But most importantly, and here is a place where the technical aspect of the book is really important, Ukraine provided very important services in terms of the management of natural gas pressure. And if you remember the title of the chapter on of natural gas, it's managing pressure. Natural gas needs to be under certain types of pressure for it to stay in place, for it not to dissipate, for it to move, for it not to kill you, like if there is an explosion. And if you want to export it, you need to have all these aspects of the pressure very clearly under control. And Ukraine, the infrastructure available in Ukraine, the natural gas storage facilities in Ukraine played a huge role there. Of course, at that time, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. Okay. But I simply want to emphasize that it was a system where both sides provided something. It was not simply Orenburg or Yamal providing natural gas. It was also Ukraine providing very important services for those exports, which in turn came to really shape the whole Ukrainian energy natural gas supply system.
So when we speak about Ukraine as a part of the Soviet Union, it's quite clear why Ukraine was this important point in the Soviet supply system. But as you pointed out, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, some Ukrainian politicians probably were not ready for changes, or they resisted some changes, or, well, since we had different opinions, right, on the future development of Ukraine after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And on the other hand, I understand that thinking about our past in terms of we should have done this probably is not very productive, but still, do you believe that something could have been done back in the 90s to reduce Ukraine's participation in this huge system, supply system, which actually centers in Russia, so that this dependency on supplies was a little bit eliminated.
Yes, a couple of things could have been done. First of all, the way subsidies worked in the early 1990s really made it very unlikely that anybody in Ukraine would have wanted to engage in any measures to increase energy efficiency, because in particular natural gas was very heavily subsidized, not only for residential consumers, which continued to be subsidized for many, many, many more years, but for industries. And those industrial leaders, those so-called red directors of the time, and later oligarchs that bought those companies, and those very directors that purchased those companies, they had no interest in saving energy. So there was no incentive in doing this. And the effect of this was continuing a particular way of doing business with Russia, a particular way of organizing energy trade that in the final analysis could not be good for Ukraine, because it maintained Ukraine as a country with some of the highest energy intensities in the world. It did not create any incentives for energy efficiency. And this is very clear in the case of natural gas, where all that web of subsidies continued for very, very long. In the case of oil, it was a little bit different, because the subsidies were gone earlier, but the way the system was organized domestically in terms of the power of certain actors and the lack of transparency, it created a lot of problems for Ukraine later on. If you remember from the oil chapter, we come to see that all of the sudden between 2005 and 2014, basically every single Ukrainian refinery goes out of business, in large part because of the way certain actors have been allowed to act, to function in a way that created short-term profits but long-term problems for the country. So your question was, what could have been done differently? I think reducing subsidies would have been very important, and creating real incentives for energy efficiency. But I want to introduce here the third type of energy, coal. And it's a little bit of a separate discussion, because, as you know, the way that chapter is built is really the coal steel value chain, so it's a little bit different. But what we saw is that in the early 1990s, every other country in Eastern Europe, or almost every other country in Eastern Europe, including Russia, was trying to reform the coal sector. Mm. Everybody was thinking about coal. Even Russia managed to reform its coal sector, and at a high social cost, for sure, managed to close many, many unviable mines. In Ukraine, politicians were also thinking about the coal sector, but they were thinking about the coal sector in a different way. They were thinking, how can we keep it alive? How can we keep people employed? And this is a little bit of a somewhat different answer to your question, because it's not really an issue here of whether Ukraine was dependent on Russian coal. It was about the political dynamics that were made possible by that continued subsidization of the mines and of all the business around it. So this was a very clear policy mistake, and we are seeing the effects even today with what is happening in the Donetsk, Donbass area.
It's stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Well, I can but ask you about Nord Stream 2. When I received your book, I was still thinking in terms, if it starts operating. Now, probably we change this formulation to when it starts operating. So what are the consequences for Ukraine, in your opinion? And today we have, particularly in Ukraine, some drastic opinions on this recent agreement, which was signed by the States and Germany. Some people say that Ukraine lost already. Some people say that we shouldn't be relying on the agreements like this, and we Ukrainians should rely more on their own resources, and we should try find our own ways to somehow reestablish ourselves, not only domestically but internationally as well. So I'm really interested in your commentary on the current situation.
So I think one thing does not exclude the other. I think Ukraine needs to be more self-reliant. We can talk more about in more detail what that could entail. Ukraine needs to be, and Ukraine will be, very cautious about what those agreements mean, because we have already the experience of the agreements in the 1990s to quote unquote provide security guarantees to Ukraine in exchange for it relinquishing its nuclear weapons. Was that fully applied? I don't think so, because look at what happened. So I think those in Ukraine who are skeptical about those agreements, I can understand them. What are the levels, at what levels is Nord Stream 2 going to impact Ukraine? Well, the first level is simply in terms of transit income, about $2 billion per year. A second level, again, goes back to the technical discussion about natural gas pressure and how the natural gas systems work. If you reduce transit, you cannot really keep the system together. You can reduce transit a little bit, 30%, 40%, but if you reduce it 80%, you just it doesn't work because there's not enough pressure for natural gas to move. And we are already seeing this with the decline in transit towards Moldova and Romania, which already declined 2 years ago, and how that has really created tremendous problems for natural gas supplies to the southeastern parts of Ukraine. But most importantly, in my view, moving natural gas transit away from Ukraine basically leaves Ukraine outside of a certain political game. Mm-hmm. Until recently, Europe had somewhat of an interest in Ukraine because they needed Ukraine for that transit. When you had the 2006 suspension of natural gas supplies by Russia, when you had 2009 suspension of natural gas supplies by Russia, the European Union played a very, very important role in trying to solve the issue. Why? Because supplies to Western Europe were affected. Now, this triangulation is no longer there, or will no longer be there. And that is going to be a real problem. But having said all this, I do not think that it was a good idea for Ukraine to continue to rely so much on natural gas transit, because eventually the European Union is moving towards other energy sources. Mm-hmm. Fossil fuels are not going to be the key element. Mm-hmm. And sooner or later, that was not going to play the role that it played 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So in a certain sense, this is forcing Ukraine to rethink its role in European, in the European energy infrastructure, in the European energy landscape. Mm-hmm. Will it be able to do that? That's a question mark. Will there be sufficiently strong oligarchic interests, to speak openly, in Ukraine with those interests, with the interests of Ukraine playing a totally different role in European energy? I think a little bit will depend on what happens with the investment fund that was promised by Germany and the US, an investment fund of, I believe, about $1 billion intended to help Ukraine smoothen the impact of the loss of transit. Will that be enough? They have talked about $1 billion, but they have actually only committed $350 million, 175 Germany, 175 the US. Is that going to be enough? I'm not sure, because we are talking here about a total rethinking of Ukraine's energy system. And it's going to be a tremendous challenge. So I think, again, given the fact that Ukrainian oligarchs have been so prominent in the country's development, I think the answer may lie there. Will they find a way to make money out of this in a way that doesn't totally siphon all the investments out of Ukraine? Mm-hmm. I think that the answer may lie there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So... The energy sector in Ukraine is also quite contentious. And as you pointed out, your book covers a lot of historical points and a lot of historical eras. Let's put it this way. It's not only 2011 and 2014. You cover a lot of the Soviet legacy in Ukraine, and then also pre-2011 events as well, particularly in Ukraine. Your book mentions the contracts and negotiations which took place between Russia and Ukraine 2009 and 2010. The book touches upon that a period when Ukraine was paying the highest price for some energy supplies in Europe. And Tymoshenko was imprisoned to some extent because of some deals, right, in this sector. So how would you describe this time period in Ukraine when there was a lot of tension between Ukraine and Russia in terms of energy supplies? Interestingly enough, this tension was followed by the escalation which took place in 2014. Of course, these events are not related probably directly, but Nevertheless, what's your take on these developments in the 2010s?
Well, your question is a very rich one. It has different aspects. Let me try to see some ways in which I can approach it. So basically what we saw in 2000 with Tymoshenko agreements was an attempt to get out of a crisis in the fastest way possible, but of course at a very, very high cost for Ukraine, because those agreements, although they had some very good things like the separation of transit and supplies, which had never happened before, like the movement towards some kind of international price, but once you look at the small print, these agreements meant that the basis price, on which then everything was calculated, was extremely high. And on the one hand, this had a positive effect in terms of already giving Ukrainian economic players a signal that they needed to use energy, use natural gas more carefully. And if you start to see the data for Ukrainian natural gas consumption already starting there, it starts to go down. And that is important. On the other hand, obviously the disbalance between, for example, transit income and what Ukraine had to pay for natural gas was gigantic. So this created tremendous pressure, for example, on the budget and increased Ukraine's foreign debt, and this was very, very problematic. But one element I want to bring into this discussion, and I don't know up to which point I'm answering your question or not, but I just want to bring it in. When we look in hindsight, we look at the Yanukovych period, and at Yanukovych as a cowardly pro-Russian little despot with a love for gold-plated toilets or whatever he had in his mansion. But in reality, if you look at that period between 2011 and 2014, or February 2014 when Yanukovych leaves, this was far from a period of smooth relations between loyal client Yanukovych and the Russians. Yanukovych tried to put pressure on Russia to change the natural gas agreement, and Russia, Gazprom, did not want to do that. So I think there's much to research about that period, much to look into in that period to understand all the complexities of the Russian-Ukrainian relationship. I have not been able to do that fully, but I simply want to flag that there was much more there than that crosses the eye looking into it. And a lot of that had to do, in turn, with the effects of the 2010 energy negotiations with Russia. 2009 and 10.
I would like to go back to one of the specifics that your book touches upon. So your book covers a vast geographical territory, and this question of energy supply appears to involve. So in this chain, Russia is only a starting point for the energy supply, and you also discuss in detail how the initial energy resource changes as it is transmitted, delivered to the destination country. So why is it important to consider this change? What does it add to the equation about how energy resources are involved in political decisions and pressures?
Thank you for raising that, because that's really very important. Two things immediately come to mind, and maybe others will. The first is that depending on what you need to do with the resource to get it to the final consumers, and whether you are simply, quote-unquote simply, transporting that resource to the final consumer, or whether you need to do a lot of things in the middle, that changes the landscape of actors that are involved. Because if you're talking about, for example, about natural gas, which quote unquote only needs to be transited you are talking about a certain type of players, let's say, involved in transit, in the pipeline, in keeping the pipeline at certain pressure and so on. But if you are talking about a type of energy that requires, for example, being refined to be of any use, because nobody can do anything with crude oil, then you bring in other types of actors into, and those actors are going to play a very different role. They are not simply going to be actors looking over a transit process. They're going to be actors that are actively involved, for example, in refining. So that already makes a difference. But secondly, the differences in the quote-unquote original resource mean that they are very important technical requirements for what you need to do for that resource to be able to be sold, to be used by end consumers, to be safely marketed and sold. And those technical differences are going to affect the entire process. Again, to take the simplest example, natural gas. It's an enterprise in managing pressure. Natural gas without pressure is nothing. And what this means is that you can do certain things, but there are other things you cannot do. For example, when we talk about the way Ukraine finally was able to get some reverse natural gas supplies, this was possible because technically you cannot direct all the transit natural gas in one gigantic pipe. You needed to have nine, and that's how from one of those nine you could take one to be reversed, for example. Or when you look at the technical sides of oil production and refining, you need to do certain things in natural gas at the beginning of the process, right there and at the production point. But in the case of oil, you can do that almost everywhere. So there you are able to, when you can do refining almost anywhere, you can bring in actors and interests at different points. So I think even at those two levels, that's already a huge difference. And two more differences, or two more reasons why that is important, is because the characteristics of that original good will affect what you can and cannot do politically, what kind of pressure you're able to exert with that good. For example, with natural gas, yes, you can supposedly stop supplies, but you cannot stop production so easily. So that's a different kind of dynamic. And finally, they also have differences for the way they can be used, not simply as means for external power or power tool, but the way they can be used to build domestic power, the way they can be used by domestic players. And actually, that was the question that set me on the journey towards this book. When I was presenting another book in Berlin in 2013, I believe, a German colleague asked me, do these differences between natural gas and oil, do they also matter domestically? And I thought, well, perhaps they matter, but I don't know. And doing the research for this book, I could find out that, yes, they do matter. Because also domestic actors, not even domestic Ukrainian actors, for example, Slovak actors, could do different things with natural gas or oil. So these differences impact actors at a variety of levels.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, I would like to go back to our Nord Stream conversation again and connect this topic with the European territory again. So after this agreement was signed, many were saying that Europe again showed that they are dependent on Russian energy supply. Is it so? Is it true that European countries are actually dependent?
Well, of course, this is different for different countries, but in general, the European Union is receiving about 35% of its oil, 35% of its natural gas from Russia. Is that being overly dependent? Is that being just enough dependent? I think to really understand the issues here, we have to look not only at the percentages, but we have to look at whether there are other sources that may be readily available if those supplies were not to be there. And of course, taking Ukraine basically out of the transit game means that there's less alternative supplies. But you also have to look at the interconnection between Western European companies and Russian companies. And here I'm a little bit worried, because if the case of Nord Stream 2 is any example, the interest of those many Western European companies are very deeply enmeshed with mm-hmm. Gazprom's interest. Mm-hmm. And this is not by chance. If you look at the way Gazprom organized the contracts with those countries in the consortium, for example, in the Nord Stream 2 consortium, the conditions that have been given to these companies are very favorable, even if many would argue that economically Nord Stream 2 doesn't really make sense. It makes sense economically for these companies, and that is something that, even if it's not about direct dependency on energy supplies, talks about a more general dependency, which is quite worrisome in my view.
Mm-hmm. And are there any options for reducing this dependency?
Well, one option is already being moved forward, which is increased reliance on renewable resources. Mm-hmm. And if the latest European Union policy proposals are fully implemented, that would have an impact on the total amount of natural gas that will be used and in the amount that will be imported from Russia as well. I don't have the data with me here. I could look that up. But certainly that can be done. Will there be the political will to fully do that? It's a little bit of a separate question. Because even the previous European Union plans to move towards renewable resources set out a few years ago were not fully implemented, in part because of the emergency created by COVID, in part because of other reasons. So if there is the political will to do so, yes, there can be a move away from that dependency, but not simply to move to other suppliers, but to move to totally different forms of energy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this will depend not only on the issue of the geographic origin of those supplies, not only on the issue of the move to renewables per se, but on the issue of whether the entire transportation system can be moved to a system based on electricity, electric-driven motors, and not fossil fuel internal combustion motors. And that is another area where there are very huge interest groups involved. If these interest groups find a niche in the new system, then that change has a possibility for success. If not, that's less likely. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, by the way, applies to Ukraine.
Well, thank you so much, Margarita. Thank you so much for your expertise, and thank you for this conversation. And again, congratulations on this book, which really complicates and problematizes the issue of energy. And I really enjoy reading it, and it really shows how multi-layered and multi-dimensional, I would say, the issue about energy is. It's not only about what energy we use, right, but it's also connected with a number of political, economical, and global strategic issues. Thank you so much, Margarita.
You're very welcome. And I have to say that you have been a very careful reader. Your questions show that you have done a great job dealing with these questions and brought a lot of other issues that are really, really important. So I really thank you. And I had a great time discussing this with you.
Thank you. Today I spoke with Margarita Balmaseda, author of Russian Energy Chains, The Remaking of Technopolitics from Siberia to Ukraine to the European Union. The book was published by Columbia University Press in 2021. Thank you for listening to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.